D'abord, je veux remercier Jérôme Joie, Peter Sinclair et l'équipe Locus Sonus pour m'avoir invité au symposium et aussi pour m'avoir accueilli dans une telle manière. Je veux aussi enregistrer mes remerciements à tous pour leur participation dans un symposium qui est, à mon avis, très engagé. Comme celui-ci. Ce que je propose à discuter a des rapports assez proches et j'espère productifs avec des autres interventions que nous avons déjà entendues aujourd'hui et hier. Et déjà entendu, comme vous pouvez voir, c'est le titre de mon présentation, which I will deliver in English. Okay. So, what I want to do in the time that remains, I audible at the back? Is that okay, volume-wise? Yeah. I want to offer a very, very brief biographical description of who I am, and then I want to introduce three complexities of sound, and these are complexities that we've heard this morning, this afternoon, and yesterday, and they're complexities that coalesce around three different levels, which, for the purpose of shorthand, I'm calling the acoustic, the perceptual, and the cultural. The cultural, in a sense, is perhaps the most sensitive and the most difficult to disentangle, and I'm not going to attempt to do that this afternoon. I'm just going to give you one anecdote about being in a taxi in Tehran. And then what I want to do is something that Jean-Paul did with much greater acuity than I will be able to marshal this afternoon. I want to think about the ways that we represent the complexities of sound. Cresson and Jean-Paul have investigated how sound and its movement in the heard world of space can be analyzed according to a variety of criteria. There's a tool set available from the detailed analysis of Cresson. But what I want to do is to look at the idea of soundscape and how the notion of soundscape provides another way of looking at the environment and the human habitation of it. And then what I want to do is offer us a brief glimpse of some of the discontents, some of those who've discovered in the ideas of soundscape things that are a little problematic. And then finally, I want to rush through a project that I'm involved with, which is called the Positive Soundscape Project. If at any time anyone has difficulty understanding what I'm saying, I do apologize for speaking in English, but if someone wants to stop me, to ask me to define something, I'm happy for that to happen. Okay, my main area of interest for many years has been how the human interacts with the landscape that they find themselves in. And I've done that in a variety of different ways. I write a lot about photography and architecture. And recently, I've moved on to engaging in different kinds of creative practice, whether it's installation-based work in sound, whether it's performances, or whether it's work on CDs. And I've done work on the radio too. I don't really want to go into my kind of biographical detail. We can talk more about that over a beer later on. But what I do want to talk about is something that's been obviously a fundamental issue for us over the past 2 days, which is, what is sound? And I want to talk about sound au niveau acoustique, or at the level of the kind of physics of sound, but instead of using those physics as a way of robbing sound of its singularity, to go back to Jean's invocation of Deleuze, and what I want to do is to want to take the physics as a point of departure to remind us of the magic of sound. Okay. Well, all sound, obviously, is mechanical energy. It's the process of molecules being squeezed together and then pulled apart. And the waves are created by those pressure variations between compression and rarefaction create the traditional sound waves that we'll all have seen. Sound travels at 366 meters a second through the air at sea level, but atmospheric pressure, temperature, and humidity alter the speed at which sound travels. But of course, sound travels through other media too, as we've heard this afternoon. If you go to the beach, perhaps go down to the coast at Nice and place one ear on the pebbles on the shore, and then one ear open to the elements, to the sky above and the clouds overhead, you can see this phenomenon of sound moving through different media at different speed very audibly. The ear, which is closer to the ground, will hear the waves crashing onto the shore at a slightly different time from the ear, which is exposed to the air around. And that's just another way of kind of demonstrating how sound moves through these media in different ways. This chain of molecular movement that creates these peaks and troughs of pressure and then release of pressure continues until the energy eventually dissipates from that reaction, and then sound, as other energies after Newton, we understand, dissipates eventually into heat. And John Tyndall, who was an acoustician in the 19th century, a British acoustician, described sound and the movement of sound in space in this lovely phrase, I think, of sonorous motion. Now, sounds, of course, can have different values in terms of their proximity. If we were to go into an anechoic chamber, an anechoic chamber is a room designed to exclude all external sound. When you go into an anechoic chamber, you settle down and you start to hear different things. First, perhaps you might hear the fabric on your clothes rubbing against other fabric, on the fabric of your jacket rubbing against other fabric on your body. Then you might hear the joints in your body and your cartilage cracking. You might hear, if you're pondering these different sounds, if you're a man, you might hear your unshaven hairs on the skin rubbing against your epidermis. You might even hear your eyelashes closing, sticking together very slightly, and then releasing. And then you hear two other sounds, sounds famously described by Cage, but experienced by anyone who's been in an anechoic chamber. You then start to hear the sounds that come from inside your body. You can hear your heart, you can hear your stomach, and you can hear your nervous system as a high-pitched whine. And these are all sounds that come from within, that have a great proximity to our body and our place in the world. But there are also sounds that come from huge distances too. With the eruption of the volcano at Krakatoa, sound traveled 5 million meters in distance in a chain of molecules that had rubbed together from Krakatoa all the way to Mauritius. And for me, the idea of an energy being transferred in that way over that distance and being audible as such is almost astonishing. And I think that those of us who work in sound, either at the analytical level or at the creative level, I think should retain a sense of awe when confronted by this energy that animates our lived experiences. And that awe is something that I think is also present when we move from the physics of sound, the question of acoustics, to the notion of perception. and the notion of hearing. And just as there's a huge journey stretching out from molecule to molecule, and vibration to vibration, compression to rarefaction, compression to rarefaction, and the creation of a sound packet that goes from Krakatoa to Mauritius, so too is there a similar voyage when that sound enters our ears. Sound first hits us, for sake of argument, at this fleshy thing here, which is called the pinna. And this shape of your pinna and this little spiral form, which is designed to amplify the sound. But given that we've all got different kinds of ears, we all transpose the sounds into our bodies in slightly different ways. Whether you have an ear pinna that extends forwards or backwards determines the frequency range, that's elements of the frequency range of the sound that then goes into your body. And you can test this while I'm talking to you by moving your pinnas back and forth. And I think if you do this, you may be able to modulate the frequencies of the sound in the room. And as sound travels in from the pinna to the eardrum, to the hammer bone, to the anvil bone, to the stirrup bone, to the cochlea, and then to the organ of Corti, before it's translated into chemical and electrical information, which is then interpreted by the brain, it travels in a process of almost unbelievable complexity. The system that forms part of our hearing, called the organ of Corti, has 1,500,000 hairs. And each of those hairs is striped with a variety of neurons that turn what was first mechanical energy into then hydraulic energy into electrochemical energy that is then transmitted into the brain for further interpretation. The whole ear has 23,500 sensitive cells that work to operate this amazing gift that we have of hearing. And this hearing can provide us with a variety of evolutionarily significant, in terms of the bioenergy devoted to hearing, over the development of the human species, for the variety of capacities. The interaural difference, which is the difference that the brain can register between a sound occurring, being processed by the left ear, and then processed by the right ear, which gives us our ability to determine location of objects and whether those objects are moving. So we use this thing called the interaural difference to be able to detect objects in the outside world and whether they're moving, and then presumably to make an assessment as to whether they're a threat or not. The smallest measurable interaural difference is 20 millionths of a second. We're able to measure that movement. The smallest sound that we can hear is a million millionth of the largest sound, if we understand the largest sound as the sound beyond which we incur chronic damage to our hearing system. And when we respond to the smallest sound, our hearing mechanism moves a physical distance which is equivalent of the tenth of the diameter of the smallest atom. So hearing has all of these amazing special qualities, just as sound itself, I believe, has these special qualities. And yet hearing is something that we subject great damage to in many different ways. A recent World Health Organization report indicated that 210,000 people a year die of coronary malaise associated with exposure to noise. Noise here understood in the acoustician's way of determining noise as that which is negative. But there are many other forms of malady that are associated with sound that aren't terminal in nature. I've just got two little slides to show you something about the way that hearing is associated with the production of sound, and the next thing that I'm going to talk about, the cultural complexities of sound. This device, which we see on screen here, is called the mosquito. I'm not sure if you have them in France. I'm sure you do. It's an antisocial system which is used to not to domesticate space, but rather to evacuate space from those who the relations of power that operate in that space have determined are people who they don't want there. And it operates by producing a high-frequency whine, which is only audible to those whose ears have not been subject to the long degradation in terms of the upper frequency range that we can respond to. So basically, for those above a certain age, there is nothing happening. There's nothing perceptible that's coming out of this system here. For those below a certain age, who still have the higher frequency range available to them, they can hear a piercing whine and decide to leave the space. But as Jean-Paul was saying earlier on, in any kind of sociology of society, there isn't just the movement from high to low, but there's also other movements. There's also possibilities of moderation and intervention. And this is a possibility of intervention, which uses the same diminution in upper frequency range response that older people have that protects them from the effects of the mosquito. And what this does is it uses mobile phone technology in a very different way to the way that we were hearing about mobile phone technology just before I began to speak, but it makes ringtones which occur at high frequency range and therefore are inaudible to older people. So this allows kids in classes to phone each other up with impunity and to set their possibly satirical ringtones off and for the other people in the class to hear a ringtone that may be some kind of commentary about the teacher in whose class they are, but it also presents them with an opportunity to build their own spatial apparatus within the kind of the panopticon of the educational system. Okay. A little bit more on hearing, and I'll explain what this device is on the left-hand side. Hearing is the second sense, chronologically speaking. We start with the sense of touch. The other senses, the sense of taste, the sense of smell, and the sense of sight, tend to be activated during what's called the perinatal passage, which is as we move through the uterus to the outside world, or if we've been born through cesarean section, as we are taken out of the cut into a life outside. So these things get activated much later than the sense of sound, which has been active from 4 months on within the womb. And this device on the left-hand side, which is the original slumber bear, is a device which attempts to replicate the white noise heard within the womb. Those of you who are parents here may notice that children, very young children, are able to be calmed down by the operation of a hairdryer or a Hoover. And it's thought that both of those things generate white noise or broadband frequencies, which replicate some of the acoustic qualities that that child may have experienced within the womb. We also hear, obviously, when we're asleep and are able to respond to sounds that occur outside our bodies while we're asleep, which I think is something very interesting in terms of thinking of what kind of autonomal system is operative, what kinds of filters are active, and which sounds are we detecting and responding to? Is it particular frequencies of sound? Is it particular sounds in relation to periods of absence of sound? As Chion has told us, while human vision is caught in the world of the cinema, in the narrow world of the cinema, not Deleuze's cinema, of course, but more like Deleuze's cinema than Kafka's cinema. Kafka, of course, talked about cinema as a straitjacket for the eyes, something that trained our sensory system. Deleuze and Chion, of course, see it differently, but Chion still thinks of cinema as something that's partial and directional, whereas hearing is omnidirectional. And Serres provides another thing, notion, that it will be the last one before we move on from perception to acculturation. And Serres suggests, and this is something that's appeared in the symposium before, that hearing isn't limited to our ears. Hearing is something that takes place in different parts of our body. I think this is a difficult question because some of the vibro-tactile sensations that we do experience through the rest of our body. If we're in a club and the bass music is particularly loud, we experience it in our stomach. Whether that can still be called hearing is something which I think is up for grabs. But I love Ceres's idea that hearing is something that stretches round the epidermal envelope to include our feet, our cranial box, our abdomen, thorax, muscles, etc. So I just want to very quickly touch on the local of the ear, kind of cultural questions of complexity that attach themselves just as they attach themselves to acoustics and just as they attach themselves to hearing. And I want to read a quote from someone called Alfonso Lingis, an anthropologist and social philosopher. And this is what he had to say. One day, while trying to drive through the chaotic traffic of Tehran, with each move I tried to make, provoking taps on the horns of the cars beside, behind, and advancing towards me, I remarked to a hitchhiker I'd picked up that after 5 blocks of this, I felt like a road lizard on bad amphetamines. Oh, they are not, like us Westerners, using the horn as a warning or threat, he said. They are like quails clucking as they feed on a ripe wheat field. And what's amazing, I think, about Lingus's quote is it gives us a sense of the cultural gears, les vitesses culturelles, which are active in our perception and hearing of sound. For Lingus, the blaring of the horns of the cars that surrounded him as he moved through Tehran was a threatening scenario. For his passenger, who'd been in Tehran for longer, there was nothing threatening about it. Indeed, it was a pastoral scene, like quails, little birds, clucking as they ate seeds in a field, just telling the other birds where they are. I'm over here, don't come and take the food, it's a waste of your biological energy, just concentrate on where you are or move to a different direction. Birds behind, birds in front. And I think Lingus's quote gives me pause when I think about sound to remember that sound, like all our other sensory apparatus, is exposed to cultural gears which have to be shifted and changed in order to move between different notions of the local. One way of dealing with these complexities, the acoustic, the perceptual, and the cultural, was developed by R. Murray Schafer and others, and was developed into this notion of the soundscape. Now, Schafer describes soundscape, en bref, as the total acoustic environment, including all noises, natural, human, and technological sounds. He proposes, and in a way, this symposium has been a concretization of that idea. He proposes a triangulation between science, art, and social sciences, sciences humaines. And from that triangulation, research into sound and into the sounded environment can move in different directions than it would if it was isolated into one of those three directions. And within soundscape work, and the soundscape work developed by R. Murray Schafer, Barry Truax, Hildegard Westerkamp, and others is work that comes with its own conceptual vocabulary and grammar that is applicable in different scenarios. There has been an incredible response. The 100 soundscape projects which have taken place in Japan and have taken place in Finland are about to take place in the United Kingdom are very interesting litmus tests of cultural activity within those different territories. The things that people associate with their country and with the sounds that their country produces are very interesting for the reasons that Jean-Paul identified earlier, the reasons why sound in particular provides us with access to particular things that occur to us and our environments. And the notion of soundscape has migrated from R. Murray Schafer's early work into a variety of different disciplinary perspectives, acoustics, bioacoustics, urban studies, and anthropology. Some soundscape research. Now, I want to talk briefly about a particular anthropologist who's engaged with soundscape work, and he's an anthropologist called Tim Ingold. And he is highly critical of soundscape as an approach, and he's highly critical of it in, I suppose, four ways, although I think the third and the fourth can be put together. The first one is the problem with a soundscape approach, he says, is that it slices the world up down these things that he calls sensorial pathways. We have soundscape, we have visionscape, we have smellscape, and they have smellscapes in Japan. There are the 100 smellscapes of Japan, which you can go and visit, and there are plaques to denote whether you are in a smellscape. And Schaefer's saying that this is false in terms of the human experience. We don't experience the world in this divided way, with all of these sensory registers parceled out, segregated. He also believes, and this is something that I think has animated some of the discussion around this symposium, that the problem with soundscape work is it conflates audio recordings with auditory experience. We take a recording of a sound, maybe we analyze it, maybe we play it back, but we assume that that sound constitutes a variably approximate representation of the real thing. And this is, in a sense, it echoes the debate that we've all been having about the virtual and the real, and the representation and the represented. Ingold believes, thirdly, that soundscape analysis concentrates on surface phenomena, on the solidity of objects, the materiality of objects. It says there's this sound taking place within this hi-fi soundscape, and what it misses out is the flux, the flux, the movement, and the rhythms of sound, which is particularly strange, given that sound is one of those sensory phenomena that's tied in with rhythm and temporal movement. And finally, Ingold accuses soundscape studies of having participated in some epistemological naivety in terms of not deciding whether sound is out there or in here. And obviously, since people began talking about sound, Aristotle and before and onwards, there's been a debate about what sound is and where sound is. And as far as Ingold's concerned, that's not a debate that takes place within soundscape studies. Now, I don't want to suggest that Ingold's ideas are as crude as these. They're not. They're incredibly sophisticated. And they come on the back of decades of work by this researcher into the idea of the landscape and scapes in general. What's interesting for me is that if you go back to his essay in World Archaeology from 1991, he does this beautiful analysis of a Bruegel painting. I think it's called The Harvesters. It shows the harvest coming in. And he analyzes this painting, not in terms of its visual meaning, but in terms of its acoustic meaning, and he identifies sound as the particular property of our inhabited world that gives us access to what is done in the world, the things that take place in the world, in order for that world to be reproduced. So I guess it's kind of quasi-Marxian inflection. Okay. I can't respond to all of those things, but I'm just going to have a quick go. Okay, soundscape does segment a particular part of the world. And I would respond to that by saying, so what? Sound has been derogated, has been diminished for centuries in Western thought and Western practice. We live in a visual-centric world, and if sound, for some moments in that world, is able to capture its own domain and protect that domain, I think that's okay. And I think there's enough going on in the other sensory registers to balance that out. I know that's a very opportunistic defence, but that's my one. Audio experience is conflated with audio recordings. I think within the soundscape world, many of those involved, Hildegard Westerkamp, Barry Truex, spend a long time exploring exactly what they mean when they analyse recordings and the differences that exist between what they're analysing and what they originally recorded. So I think this is a real red herring on the part of Ingold. I don't think there's this conflation that goes on. The notion of concentrating on surface phenomena and ignoring the flux is a very strange one after these 2 days, because we've spent 2 days talking about the flux and the rhythms and the temporality of sound. And so does soundscape work, and some of the sound maps produced in soundscape work, you get the sense of the dynamic movement of sound over diurnal time, over monthly time, over calendrical time. So you get this movement between the macro time of the hour or even of the series of minutes and then the macro time of the year and the seasons. The question of whether sound is in here or out there is a false question. It's a question which is proposed by philosophers in the face of language. And Wittgenstein showed us the way to respond to these kinds of arguments when he said, leave the icy ground and return to the rough ground of conversation. So Wittgenstein's idea is that these abstract hypothetical pronouncements work at the level of language. But as soon as that language is taken away from its abstract identity and put into conversation, they don't work. Because you can have a conversation about it. You can change your mind. You can move. You can put out a manifesto. Someone can put out a counter manifesto. And there's the opportunity to change and move. And as I said, the whole audio extranaut experience for me has been one that reveals how animated all of these questions are. They're not ones that we are ignoring. Okay, from the sublime to the banal. In the time that remains, and I've got, how long? Is that 5, 10? Okay. I'll do it in 7. Okay. So a project that I'm involved with that explains in part why I've been so opportunistic in trying to defend soundscapes from Ingold's and others' criticisms has the title The Positive Soundscape Project. It's a multidisciplinary project that involves 5 different institutions. I'm in the second institution from the left and engaged in what is entitled Sonic Art. So what we have is we have people working in laboratories, people producing artistic practice, people looking at psychoacoustics, people looking at social science practices, and people exploring the physiological effects on sound, of sound. It's a project funded by the UK government through the Engineering and Physical Sciences Research Council. So, one of the aspects of the project involves this little device, which is up here on the top right, which is called a Sonoscout, which glues the GPS data onto sound waves so that you can then recreate these GPS sound maps and then analyze those sound maps in laboratory conditions. Another aspect of it is a social scientific aspect, which involves sound walking practices. Sound walking as a term was invented in 1974 by Hildegard Westerkamp, one of the people involved in the soundscape original projects, and has since evolved into a methodology which is used by social scientists to ascertain different aspects of the world that are revealed through the process of walking and listening. And Mags Adams, who's a social scientist involved in the project, uses sound walking both with expert groups, with architects, urban planners, and others, and with representative samples of the population. We have 2 researchers who are looking at physiology and psychoacoustics, looking at sound in relation to galvanic skin response, the change of conductivity on the surface of the skin due to stress or lack of it, And towards the end of the project, we're going to be pushing people into long, foreboding chambers that are called fMRI, frequency MRI scanners, magnetic resonance imaging scanners, so that we'll be looking at brain activity when certain sounds are played back. Then we're also looking at the quantitative metrics, whether we can analyze sound according to particular elements that are there that contribute to our experience of the soundscape that can be ultimately determined to be positive or otherwise. And then all of us are building this little piece of software which will become freely available called a soundscape sequencer, which will allow people to build 3D sound environments at the level, hopefully, of acoustic Lego. We have, you know, Lego, where you're building blocks. So hopefully one version of it will be like a Lego kit where you can build your soundscapes out of Lego, so kids can build their own ideal soundscape. You can work with people from different demographic backgrounds, different age backgrounds, to produce soundscapes that reflect their experience of movement, migration, etc. Peter Kuzak, who Roger has recently was at the conference that Roger talked about to do with les lieux extrêmes. Peter Kuzak is involved in the project as a research fellow, and he's developed this thing called Favorite Sounds. The Favorite Sounds project started in London, Favorite Sounds of London, then it traveled to Chicago and Beijing, and now, as this poster indicates, it's moved to Manchester. And this is one of the techniques that we're using to sort of hoover up responses to the soundscape. What do people identify as positive about the world they hear, and why do they identify as positive? Well, in Manchester, what people identified as positive were those things that appear in the bottom section there. People chatting, canal boats, Manchester United chanting, the trams, the calm of the city at night, the sound of silence, the trains, traffic, children laughing, and birds. The challenge of the Positive Soundscapes project for me is to make good on its interdisciplinary claims. It's all very well to say we have an interdisciplinary team of artists, social scientists, different stripes of acoustic scientists, but how do they work together? Well, one of the ways that we work together is we use the same study locations, the same case studies. In other ways, we work in the same place at the same time. The other thing that we're trying to do is to exchange data between the different groups. We don't want the artists to illustrate what the scientists are doing. We want the scientists to use what the artist produces, raw data, for their own experimentations. We're also involved in producing a kind of documentary of methodologies that will illuminate the different approaches to sound and the sounded world. That's the surface of an anechoic chamber, which I referred to earlier on, which are those places where you can hear all of the elements of your body. So these are some kind of prototype artistic responses. And Peter Kuzak is pursuing many different artistic approaches, and I just wanted to talk about a few of mine. The piece on the right is a streamed composition that I made called Sondagsmaler, which is Danish for Sunday painter. It's a very long and involved explanation of why that's called that, but that's what it's called, which is okay. This is this book which I edited in response to this research project called Autumn Leaves, which brings together a number of different perspectives, artistic, scientific, anthropological, Tim Ingold, and others. And there's also accompanying it an audio compilation, which is just about to go online. And I can tell Jérôme when it goes online, and it's going to be free to download. And as you can see from the list of participants on the right, that include Locus Sonus, there's a very, very exciting group of people from very, very different backgrounds who are coming together to explore how the world is made audible. In terms of my responses to this, as well as having produced the book and compiled the audio compilation, I'm very interested in how you can use, how you can make sound art without using sound. And these are these things which I call sound cards, and they're created using a machine, which is one of the noisiest machines I've ever heard. They're pieces of metal which are carved by a machine that looks like a lathe, and it's just left to go on overnight, and it creates this terrible racket. And so I've been developing, this is a quotation from Charles de Gaulle, "Silence is the ultimate weapon of power," where I'm kind of playing with these quotations being about silence, but being created through this monstrous racket. I've also been doing these performances involving these little badges, "I hate silence," "I love silence," which have been, sometimes they've just been performances of the kind of getting a large number of people to wear these and to occupy various places and just to see what happens. Others have been more involved with explaining the kind of what this might mean to choose to like or to dislike silence. And then I've done a series of kind of sound and image pieces, which I'm just going to finish on if I've got 3 minutes left. Okay. Just before I say merci, and then I'm just going to play these three video pieces. This is me DJing for 25 hours non-stop in a van traveling around the périphérique in London, the M25. But that's nothing to do with this project. I just thought I'd show you what I look like when I used to have a huge top knot. Okay, so this first thing. Okay, they're all very short. And they're all prototypes. And they're all intentionally quiet. That one was produced in one of the study sites that we're looking at from all of these different perspectives, the sound walking, the qualitative and quantitative analysis, and as was this one, which is another location in Manchester.
He gave us all to be a saviour for you. That's Jesus. The question is whether you're prepared to trust him. Word is simply believe in the Lord Jesus. That's what we say. It's your way of salvation and the only way of salvation. Questions asked in scripture. What must I do?
And finally, this is interesting given the discussion Leo led yesterday about computer games. This is a modification of a video game called Stalker, which was created by myself and Corrado Morgana. I'm just going to turn the sound down. I don't like loud sound. And thank you very much. Merci à tous. Et c'est tout. Merci.